Alright, my name is Chris Bell, and today's date is the 15th of June 1984, and I'm speaking with Colonel Carson at his home. And it's our last day, which I believe we got to about May 1944, just before the invasion, and we had been talking about various roles. I think you were with AGRA?
AGRA, yeah.
Yeah, and we talked about funny tanks, and you didn't have them, or many of them. But we discussed your role, the organization of your unit and whatnot. And perhaps a good place to begin was that you mentioned that your unit went over just a few days before Army went over, headquarters. Now, when would that be?
I'm not absolutely sure, but I looked it up after I talked to that. It must have been about a month after the invasion. Mm-hmm. In fact, it may be, if it wasn't in this, it was something else I saw, but it seemed to me that it was just about 5th, 6th, something like that, of July, rather than the 6th of June.
Mm-hmm.
So probably about a month. Now, I'm not sure whether Army... I think probably what happened is the Advance Army went over ahead. That's the sort of operation side. And then all the rear part came along, probably a little behind us.
Mm-hmm.
I know they came about the same time as we did, because we used to report to them for planning and for...
Do you remember offhand if it was all done according to the original plan, or that things had been held up perhaps a little bit?
Because
I know at this time the beachhead was about all there was. They hadn't broken out yet.
No, actually they had, when we got there, they had just taken Caen, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But they hadn't gone much past it. In fact, the Orne River, I think it was Orne River, was ours, but only barely. And I don't know whether the program was there or not, because we really weren't in that. We'd been so recently foreign, we didn't get into any of the original planning. We just had to fit in to some of the, well, I suppose, heavy engineer support, primarily, we were running, or trying to run.
Are you okay sitting there? Is the sun bothering you at all?
No, it's all right.
Okay, so you got over, say, in mid-July or thereabouts. Were you put to work immediately, or were you... back at the bridgehead waiting for something to happen?
We went in the assembly area. Everybody who came ashore did, so they married up with the rest of their bits and pieces that perhaps got lost or didn't get there.
Well, did you come by way of the Mulberries, or did you go
no,
by?
No, we came with a landing craft.
Mm-hmm.
The Mulberries were under construction. Probably were being used for some supplies at that stage, although I don't know. We didn't have any problem. We settled in one night, and I think then we moved to another location the second night and went to work. With some troops put under us, and I suppose as they came ashore, additional more. I remember just the Army troops engineers who were near us in the initial stages. And we weren't very busy until more troops got ashore.
Yeah. Well, your job was really the heavy-duty, larger items, like waterworks, as you were saying. So I guess there really wasn't any of the... And no bridges to build, because you only crossed the Orne River, I guess.
Well, yes, we actually fairly soon got into building heavier bridges. The assault bridges would probably be 12-ton bridges, and we'd get into the 40-ton bridges. Not we ourselves, but the troops under us.
Mm-hmm.
Although that varied a bit. The Orne had, as I remember, one 40-ton bridge and two 12, one of which had been broken because somebody... Some enthusiast tried to bring a captured German tank over it.
And went right down,
down to the bottom of the river.
Poor chap. Are you talking about the Canadian sector alone, or this is the entire front?
No, Canadian sector. Well, it was Canadian and British. The 1st British Corps and the 1st Canadian Corps were in the 1st Canadian Army.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm sorry, 2nd Canadian Corps and the 1st British Corps were in the Canadian... They composed the Canadian Army when the Army took over. I suppose until that time it was just two separate core activities.
Probably all under the auspices of 21st Army Group.
No, 21st Army Group weren't even ashore by that time.
No.
I don't think, under the auspices certainly, but I think that it was part of the plan and well known that they came under the operational control of the 1st Canadian Army. That's why I think probably the advanced part of the 1st Canadian Army, the operations one, were ashore. And that we're in fact conducting those cooperative things.
Yes.
And but the great bulk, of course, had not fully established itself. We were in the Conn area for quite a while, mm-hmm. and quite a while. I have no idea. I've forgotten really. Pretty well until going forward to work on the assault crossing of the Seine, which wasn't really much of an assault crossing because the Germans disappeared. It wasn't really as much of an operation as we had expected it to be.
What had you planned for?
We had planned for a major opposed river crossing of a major river. In fact, we trained in England for that.
Up in Scotland, is that the one you did?
No, not in Scotland, but in Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. I think it was Yorkshire. Certainly, Scunthorpe was the location, and I don't remember the name of the river, but Scunthorpe was the town near which we were in England. And it was definitely, although I don't think we knew it until a little later, the planning or the practice crossing for the Seine.
Indeed. How wide was the Seine at the point you were supposed to cross?
I suppose about 400 or 500 feet.
And was the method collapsible boats, or were you using landing craft?
Oh no, collapsible boats. They very seldom use. In fact, I don't know of any river crossing that we did that used, in fact, landing craft. Mm-hmm. They used the funny tanks and the swimming tanks and that sort of stuff in the assault. And there were a lot of funny little things, but not landing craft as such.
Things like the ducks, I suppose.
Ducks, yes, very definitely, yeah.
Yeah. It just seemed to me that you'd be exposing bare bodies to bullets with
yes.
those very thin, collapsible boats.
You
know, if it's an
you were in landing craft too. They weren't really very very armored. They had a little thin armor in some parts, but they're quite open.
More than anything else, I should think.
Yeah. Running all the way from the straight paddling and assault boats, which is a most uncomfortable procedure, I guess. I didn't ever did it, thank God. We trained at it the last time.
And they didn't have motors on the backs?
Those didn't, but the majority were with the storm boats, which did have motors, big 75 horsepower, outboard motors. A lot of different kinds of motorboat things. And then when we got further on to the Rhine, the Navy did come up with some of their gadgetry. And I think there may have been a few assault boats then. Mm-hmm. Probably were, but they were.
I think at that time they developed something called the Weasel.
Yes, well, the Weasel was a swimming carrier type of thing, which was much like a swimming or an amphibious. It was an amphibious carrier, really. Mm-hmm. They had them then, yes. They were certainly used, but they're not. No, they'll sink just as well as anything else.
Well, what sort of opposition did you meet at the Seine then? Did you meet any?
Well, our responsibility was the heavy bridging stuff. We really weren't fully active in the assault crossing itself. The assault went across at night and under, I suppose, some smoke and other kind of cover. And there wasn't much opposition on the other side. It just went on through. So our operation of building bridges was a much quieter affair than we anticipated. Yeah.
Well, tell me, were there any bridges held, or had they all been destroyed by the Germans? Or was it simply a sector without bridges?
There were bridges in the sector we were in. The Don La Havre, I guess there were some bridges, but I guess they'd all been destroyed. I don't know.
Yeah.
We were the next group in. First British Corps were on the coast. We were the next group in, and although I remember the little town we were at, it wasn't a very big town, and I don't suppose you can even find it on the map.
What was it called?
I don't know. I remember looking at it, and I remember knowing where it was on the map years ago, and I really have never thought about it since.
Mm.
I've never gone back to any battlefields, and nor have I studied them, so I really have a pretty vague idea of what the names of a lot of the towns we went through were.
Is it something you prefer not to, or just not interested enough to...
For quite a while I wasn't interested, but you see, in most cases, people who went back to these things were reserves rather than the regular force people, so the regular force people are caging it over, yeah. I didn't happen to be in Germany any time when there was any of these things going on.
And it seems to be that with reserve people, that the war seems to be a more important feature of their lives, whereas a permanent force type would see it as an event in their life as opposed to the central issue. At least that's what I've found in my research. Dealing with veterans.
I suppose that's a fair assessment, yes, because it's certainly in regular force people it was a very important event, but it was only one of the military activities they had to do, where one or a group, most important group of them. But some of the reserves, that was the only military activity they did, mm-hmm. and so their almost their entire military activity, they weren't necessary. That were only perhaps were only in there for the war. Some stayed on in the reserves afterwards, mm-hmm. and I think that's probably true. Let's face it, it's maybe even more realistic than the regular, because they train only for war. We train for peacetime, too.
Yes. But they say in peacetime you're training for war, sir.
Yes, the difficult way, with the counting and that sort of stuff, has to go through.
What kind of bridge did you build at the small? Was it a pontoon?
Probably a floating Bailey bridge, class 40, which is a pontoon bridge, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were some class 40 rafts as well. They were to take over the heavier equipment.
How heavy could you get over on one of those bridges?
40 tons, a tank or bulldozer. They were usually for bulldozers and things of that sort. But or the tanks would go on, of course, certainly. Or two or three scout cars or light tanks, that sort of thing.
Well, tell me, I know this is kind of off again, but could one tank go over at a time, or could you get one in the center, one at the beginning, or... You know what I'm saying? That
if you had light tanks, you could have two, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, the later ones took more room, so that usually was one or two. On a class 40 floating ferry. Anyway, it was class 40, and you had a 40-ton tank with only one. There were a lot of 28-ton tanks. You couldn't get two of those aboard.
Yeah.
You might get a few other things for it, and often did. And quite often a few extra troops along with them, that sort of thing. But,
you're pretty careful about it, I guess. Because if
anything they took terrible chances. Actually, what we used to very often do is double up the number of pontoons you put under some of the lighter ferries, like the Class 12 ferry. Class 9 ferry, originally, it was.
Mm-hmm.
We made it to Class 12, and then we were putting stuff up to Class 15 and by putting extra pontoons. And I remember one ferry we had 8 engines on it. And you're only meant to have 2 or 4.
So you're increasing the buoyancy and the horsepower, so it would have been very unstable, I should think.
It wasn't very stable, no. But it used to charge across it a hell of a cliff. that was later on near Nijmegen, across the Rhine, over the Netherrhine. And it was really meant for light communications type thing, and it became, was called the commander's ferry. They painted everything white and people in yellow slickers until we got strafed. But the Germans didn't have very many planes up, so it wasn't that dangerous. Actually, rafting was really the most exciting part of our business, and we did a lot of it, because there was an awful lot of ground was flooded, and a lot of river crossings necessary.
Would you carry the rafts with you, or would they be at staging areas? You make them.
You make them out of components of a bridge.
I see.
And the they were very close to the same thing as a continuous class 40 bridge, the big ones. The ones that were rafts only, like the class 9 ones, which were light assault raft, were they weren't made into bridges normally. In fact, I don't think ever you could probably join a few together, but they were very quick to load, flip up the thing, the landing bay, or flip it down on and up, and away you go.
Mm-hmm.
They were rafts and designed as rafts, and that's all. And they were carried quite far back by the bridging companies. We would sometimes have them with us, and if you're coming towards a river, you would always have them well forward, available for the job that they were anticipated for.
Mm-hmm. What sort of priority would you have to transportation, or would you be completely self-sufficient in transport?
We would probably be given the highest highest priority to get those sorts of things forward.
Mm-hmm.
Probably ammunition took a higher priority, but. There wasn't much conflict, really, and that sort of thing. Generally speaking, we were doing it one place, and the ammunition and stuff were doing it in another place. There was a great deal of competition. They're very seldom wanted to put ammunition dumps exactly the same place as we wanted to put bridging dumps. But we'd put these things on the ground well ahead, as far ahead as we could get them camouflaged, so that you could bring them up in very quickly when you needed them. And once in a while, you didn't need them, but usually did.
Well, tell me, this same advance, had it been a rapid advance after the breakout, the rush to the Seine, or was it something that had been a slow, gradual progression?
It was relatively rapid to what we'd had. After they got out of the place, gap, it wasn't very far to the Seine.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty rapid, yes. And I suppose that's why the Germans weren't too ready to have another stand on the Seine. We assumed they were. I could say it's very rapid. It was quite a bit more rapid from then on, right through to the Walkern or to
I guess so the weather started holding
Dutch
you
border,
up. Yeah.
And in fact, little pockets like Calais were left behind, and by that time I had left that job. Just after the Seine, I left that job and went to command the Corps Fuel Company. Thank God. The 31st Fuel Company.
Why do you say thank God, if I might?
Well, it's much better getting back with troops than sitting around the headquarters. Planning's fine, but it's much better to be doing some of the things.
Mm-hmm.
And I much preferred it.
Well, did you see it as being a necessity to command troops in action in the field during a time of war to further your career at that point?
Yeah, I would think so, we assume so. That wasn't part of the thing, really. You were sent over to do these things, and that's what we trained to do, really, to command troops, and certainly I'd had a staff college training, so I was also trained as a staff officer,
mm-hmm.
but I much prefer to command troops than being a staff officer, so it's just that simple. I think I was fired, I'm not sure.
Really?
For losing some of the assault boats that we had nothing to do with. I was delighted to be fired, if that's what it was.
Who,
General Walsh.
Oh, yeah, the old General Walsh. But you and Colonel Wilkins had quite a bit to say about General Walsh.
Oh, he was a very good wartime commander. He didn't brook any nonsense or any delay about anything. If I was fired, he didn't like Spike Birmingham much, because Spike Birmingham is very much of a broad brush artist and charge ahead and get it done. And I must admit that I rather favored some of the ways that Spike was doing things, but when he, in effect, moved me over to the field squad, he said, I guess you're getting fired. You can assume it's fired, because you haven't kept Spike from playing silly bugger all the time. Well, anyway, the only thing he could accuse me of, we lost a bunch of assault boats,
mm-hmm.
and they were picked up by the British.
And they latched onto them, did they?
Well, I don't ever remember having anything to do with the bloody assault boats, so why we lost them, I have no idea. Some unit under us, I guess, did. But,
so it was a pretense, then?
I didn't even know we were responsible for them, so it didn't matter, and he had to have something to go about.
Mm-hmm.
But I was delighted. I then went off and did what I was trained to do a bit more.
Now you went to where?
To the 31st Field Company, which was one of the Second Corps Troops Field Companies. It was, I suppose I got the date here somewhere.
It sounds like about late August, maybe? Early September?
I think so. Just a minute. Actually, it was September.
And you were, what, a major at this point?
Yep. I was a major practically all the way through the war.
Now, as a major, would you be commanding this company?
Yes.
Who would you be under?
I was under a lieutenant colonel, the CRE of the engineers are commanded by a lieutenant colonel, and there are four independent units working under him.
Mm-hmm.
By independent, I mean we're completely self-accounting. His little headquarters really had nothing except operational control over us, and no real administration. I suppose we supported them occasionally administratively, because although they had cooks and that sort of stuff, we were completely self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, the field squadrons, field squadrons, really the same term,
Would they be interchangeable with the armored divisions and...
The field squadrons were designed for the armored divisions and called such when they worked with an armored division, and their companies when they were not. They weren't quite the same. They had a few more... I think the field squadrons later on had some of these light...
APC ideas?
Well, they certainly had APCs, no, and the light swimming ones used weasels.
Weasels.
I'm not sure. If they did, it was only a few of them did. It wasn't a normal thing. The field companies normally would have a wheeled armored car or two, whereas the field squadrons would probably have a tracked one. And that wasn't even exclusive either. The White Scout car was a great big lumbering armored vehicle. We had about three of them or four of them in each company. We had a few other semi-armored things. Sometimes you'd have a carrier for reconnaissance purposes and that sort of stuff. Because you had in the headquarters of a field company a major and a captain of the 2IC and probably two to three lieutenants as the liaison officers or recce officers.
So you didn't have traditional platoons, you just had...
Then you had three platoons. And actually, very shortly after I took over the 31st Field Company, they added another 50 men to us, made up of British pioneers, and they went everywhere with us. Now, they weren't completely mobile, so we begged, borrowed, and stole enough vehicles to make them mobile and move around under the vehicle, so they wouldn't be any use if they didn't.
But why had they been attached to you?
Workload. We had a... We never had any time out of battle as the infantry did. We were working all the time, and you'd just be absolutely exhausted if you didn't have some extra physical manpower. And quite a lot of it was pretty ordinary. Bone bashing, mining roads, craters, and that sort of stuff.
So partially trained pioneers could be of great benefit.
Sure. In fact, since we kept the same ones, we trained them to a fairly high standard. In fact, eventually we had them building bridges, too. They loved it.
Well, what was the main task of a field company?
Well,
in your field company, say.
Any field company, all engineers have the task of assisting the rest of the army to live properly and efficiently on the battlefield, and to aid them to be able to move and live on the battlefield. So ours was the same, but a little less specific, because we didn't have a recognized group of people we supported. Mine being the third field company in the Corps of Troops, normally followed behind or worked with the 3rd Division. Actually, sometimes it was the 3rd Division, but...
The 3rd Division had their own...
Well, each division had three field companies, but the workload in their area was nearly always in excess of just three field companies.
Mm-hmm.
So, and sometimes they're all off with brigades, and then they would borrow another one, mine, if it was a... the normal pattern, and I would probably be working very close to and around divisional headquarters, supporting that sort of thing, supporting the funny troops, the gunners and the tanks and that sort of stuff that were assigned, because very often the division had a lot of extra people added to it.
Mm-hmm.
Not very often would we put under command, but sometimes we put under command of the division. Usually we were left under command of our boss, the CRE.
The idea being you do the job.
We do the job and then revert back to him again.
Mm-hmm. Is this what you were talking about before, the economy of engineers?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But if you had a specific job, like a crossing of a river or something of this sort, and there's a specific engineering job that was in excess of the capabilities, quantity capabilities of the division engineers, the division would be allotted some more engineers to help them. And they may be probably would be under command for that particular crossing operation or whatever it may be. I remember one time being called up and said, "Oh, you're the starboard experts." I said, "I never even seen a bloody starboard." "No, but what did you have in mind?" "Well, we were going to assault across a part of the south beam of the Walkern Island until somebody got up close enough and found there wasn't enough water to put a salt boat in it, which has a bloody great swamp." So we didn't do that. But anyway, we had an evening of getting out our pamphlets and ordering ourselves in stormboat companies or stormboat work groups.
Now the Stormboat were those collapsible boats we were talking about earlier, weren't they?
No, the Stormboats were the solid ones with the big power on the back, big
sort of like barges almost.
They were quite flat bottom. They could run right up on the beach and then back off. They couldn't power themselves off because they only had one gear forward.
A real patent.
75 horsepower Evinrudes. Mm-hmm. Beautiful things, but God, they were tough.
This is a big, long...
they weren't the arms. They were just like a very big outboard motor. And they would come up as you got close, you'd pull them out of the water so they didn't drag. Mm-hmm. Or they'd bounce up, but it didn't matter too much. They'd push until they hit something and they come, making a hell of a noise.
Well, I dare say that going into Belgium and into Holland, the engineer's workload really increased, I mean, with all the physical obstacles involved.
Yeah, that's right.
Had you been training for this kind of obstacle?
Yes, mostly.
It had been foreseen.
The type of manufactured obstacle wasn't very different than the beach obstacles. One thing we did find that we didn't have much training on was a huge... bombs they'd put in the roads and put a mine on top of them. We had 1,000-pound bombs in the roads with mines on top. They were a real bugger to get out, too.
Well, how was it any different than simply a normal mine?
Well, mine is about this way, usually weighing about 25 to 30 pounds. Sometimes put two or three of them, one on top of the other. We knew about that. But we didn't know that they would, I suppose you might have suspected, put them on top of oil, sometimes 1,000-pound bombs, or naval torpedoes. I just dig them in the road and set them. The ones that were not acoustically or magnetically or electronically set off were just like an ordinary mine. You had to then disarm the mine and disarm the connector, make sure there weren't too many booby traps in it, and then drag it out. We took a few of them around Calais and quite a bunch.
Well, what would set off? I'm thinking of the metallic and the acoustic. Would a truck or a soldier, what would it take?
Oh, no, it's usually a vehicle.
So you wouldn't have to set off the mine itself?
The magnetic ones needed a fairly good-sized truck or a tank or something. And normally they were not just the first go. Sometimes they had a trip mechanism. It was the third or fourth.
Open for a condo, I guess.
That's right. Yeah.
I guess that's to the Germans' advantage because you knock out more with a truck than you would with knocking a soldier's legs off in the mine.
Well, the soldier's legs were really only done by the shoe mines and the anti-personnel mines. And they were very nasty little things, but we knew lots about those. We had lots of unpleasant ones, too. But the shoe mine, the little box mine, was very hard to detect because there's not much metal in it, and then basically none. So the mine detector wouldn't show it up.
How would you find it?
Pushing and prodding, just coming against something and then scraping the earth away, seeing there's one.
Would you have a good idea, where they would normally put the shoe mines, or would it just be a case of haphazardly finding?
Yeah, well, for instance, if you have a paved road and there's no breaks in the pavement, you know damn well there's no shoe mine there. You could have some big mines on it, but you can walk across an anti-tank mine, and the person won't blow you off because you need something a bit heavier to do that. Very often, though, they would put anti-personnel mines in them to keep the people away from trying to kill them. We didn't get into as much of that as the divisional engineers did, but we did get into some. Usually, in the areas where it was fairly defined where there were mines, bridges, bridge approaches, and that sort of stuff, where they demolished things, and then they would mine all the natural places to make a new bridge. Mm-hmm. We would very often have to delouse the area for a heavier bridge, say on the other side of the demolished bridge, knowing that there was a lighter one that the division engineers put through. And it was, we had our normal complement of good, qualified individuals who were able to do that. All Sanford were meant to be able to do it, but they weren't all legal. Then when you get into the heavily defended areas like the Reich Wall of the Forest, and you'd do a lot of clearing, you'd find people would be, thing over like this, and shrapnel coming down the... An individual can't do it for more than about 20 minutes without going stark, staring mad. So the shock or deep stress, or whatever you want to call it. It was pretty high in some people. Not as high in ours, because we didn't do it as often as they did. Mm-hmm. In some cases, worse, because when we did do it, we weren't so damn used to it.
Well, tell me, would there be areas in the rear that would be roped off or cordoned off somehow, that minefields?
Oh, yes.
And you would just leave them?
Well, we very often were the ones that had to do it, cordon them off, or if they were cordoned off or marked by some of the... They were being marked, not cordoned,
mm-hmm.
By the forward engineers. We might have to cordon them off if it's going to be an important area, and leave them in some cases. Sometimes we'd have to clear them. It depended upon where it was and how vital the area was. For instance, an approach to a bridge, you might have to clear it to get the new bridge in.
Mm-hmm. Would you find that if you would come across an ex-German aerodrome, that in order to get... I don't know, I guess it wasn't too necessary because the airfields at the rear were so close, but would you have to mine them carefully, and would you have to rebuild the airstrips themselves? Or was that your domain?
We didn't do much of it. There was another group behind us, which were the 21st Army Group engineers. They did most of that kind of thing. We were working exclusively in the Canadian Army area.
Mm-hmm.
And we did occasionally get into some of these things and start things off and then hand it on to somebody else. Generally speaking, we might probably only do some reconnaissance of the things and then some assessment of what was really needed.
Mm-hmm.
Things depended upon how fast you're going, really. Sometimes you're going fairly fast, there's a lot to be done. Slow down, then there was a lot more stuff where you'd sort of branch out a bit more.
Well, jumping ahead a bit, when the Canadians moved into Antwerp, say, would you be working on the docks trying to get the equipment in order, in working order, whatnot? Because
no,
a lot of it was booby-trapped, I take it.
Yeah. No, we weren't. We did... By that time, I was no longer with the Agri, and I suppose the Agri did have some of that to do.
Mm-hmm.
My field squadron was in support of the assault on the Walcheren Island, and we actually did some ferrying of equipment across the Scheldt estuary,
mm-hmm.
to Walcheren Island from the south shore, and also along South Beaven to ostensibly go in across the causeway. We actually didn't, because it fell after the troops got across the causeway, and there really wasn't any need.
Was the initial assault under fire?
Oh, yes. The initial assault of Walcheren?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The initial crossing of the Scheldt.
Yes, that was one of the funny tanks that did a lot of that. In fact, my young brother was in that assault.
In 79.
In 79.
Okay.
And so the landing was successful, but not very successful. There's still a bunch of Germans on the other end of the island, the north side of the island. And the main road onto the island comes across the South Beaven, which is this long peninsula, the other side of the Scheldt. And it was very heavily defended. It was a very vicious place. That's where they thought we might do some assault boating. There wasn't enough water, but there was a hell of a lot of... they couldn't, slug across that... I think they did go across to a degree in the little assault boats, the little folding ones, which the infantry paddle themselves and then get out and leave them. Probably they weren't much use for another thing. The storm boats would make multi trips,
mm-hmm.
whereas the assault boats might come back and do more trips, but didn't. And very often there's a fair wastage in them. I don't know. I'm not sure. I have an idea they did use some assault boats. So that's a strictly an infantry deal, not an engineer deal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's strictly they did. The engineer did do them occasionally, but not very often.
Yeah. But they're so small, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's six or eight people, I think, no more.
That's right.
Well, was it impressed upon you the importance of capturing the entire island? Because with the island, the opening of Antwerp really depended upon it, didn't
you
it?
Couldn't open Antwerp until it's captured, yeah.
There were
some pretty big guns on it.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, Antwerp was essential because no port had been liberated up to that point. It was all depending upon Antwerp.
Yeah, there were little ports like Calais and and this sort of thing. But these aren't ports. Antwerp was really the only big port.
Yeah. The other places are more like channel ferries.
Channel ferries,
yeah.
called even Calais. See, it's just a little mole, little, must be like, I gather. We were in there for about a week. War passed us on, as a matter of fact. We had been working for, I think it was 3 years, and they said goodbye as they moved on, but didn't tell us where to go. Went on working and taking mines out of roads, and suddenly somebody found us and said, hey, move up here, just outside of Antwerp, which we did. And then we came back in around the other side to the south shore of the Scheldt. But there were some unpleasant battles around there. That Leopold Canal wasn't very far away, and then there was another canal, I forgot, Canal du Nord, I think. But there's an awful lot of battling on. We didn't have an awful lot to do with it, but we did. We were waiting to do one, and it didn't materialize. You see, you spend, and when you're doing, you have a small unit. You don't know what the hell is going on or why until you get an order to do it, and you're never too sure why you're doing it either. But you do it.
Were you really in that much isolation? You weren't. I know, well, you weren't told the big picture.
Corps troops were in support of people that they didn't see too often. We'd get the good big picture of a specific operation if you're working straight for them. But if you're just following along behind them, doing assigned tasks assigned by Corps troops, you didn't get an awful lot of information. No.
I guess
a lot, though, when you were actually doing an activity like a bridge or different things. Mm-hmm. The bridges were much the most interesting part of our lives.
Did you build any bridges of greater permanence? Or was that not really your mandate?
No, we didn't, really. A few of them that we built may have stayed there. You see, the dry bridges, the ones that go from one side to another and don't have any floating gear, were not too hard to maintain, and some of those things may well have stayed, I don't know. Mm. But many of the ones that we built were then replaced by engineers behind using civilian equipment so they could release the military stuff for the next assault phase. Mm-hmm. But until they got to the Rhine, they didn't waste very much bridging equipment if they could avoid it, because they needed a tremendous amount there.
Well, the move across France and then Holland, or Belgium and then Holland, is it a, I'm showing my ignorance here, but are there a lot of rivers to cross?
Yes.
And the necessity is for lots of equipment.
Every bloody river, canal, whatever, the Germans have blown the bridges, yes. Every canal. Very, very few bridges were captured intact. And I would say that we built, God, I don't know, there's a whole thing on bridging in France normally. We built, I would think that on average, much you might build 5 bridges, maybe 6. But it's hard to say whether that's normal. It's somewhat dependent on how fast things are going.
Would they all be rather small in size? Or
the great majority were probably 100, 110, 150 feet, even some of the 60 and 70. But they were rather small. If you possibly could, it was much better to have one from dry pier to dry pier, in other words, just a small bridge. And often that was possible, but it's only the very big ones you put floating equipment in. And when you put floating equipment in, you nearly always then plan to somehow replace it with a permanent bridge later, because it certainly isn't permanent. They can go on for quite a long time, but it takes an awful lot of people to keep them floating, keep them operating properly.
Maintenance is one thing, but also the level of productivity of a bridge like that is very low. I mean, you're not getting that much across at a time.
Well, all these bridges are only one way. One vehicle going through, and very often army troops behind us would be putting in the other way, one right beside it for the return, or maybe for the up, didn't matter, whichever side of the thing it was, but putting in another bridge to make it double it. And sometimes taking bridges apart and making them double, with you can make a double carriageway, single bridge, it's a fairly slow process. And they did quite a bit of that. We didn't generally do it unless we were sitting still for quite a while.
So you were at Antwerp and in the Scheldt area.
Mm-hmm. Then we went up to Nijmegen. We spent most of the winter in Nijmegen after the Arnhem assault. And they were brought, the two or three Americans and the British, were brought back, mostly to us, not entirely. And we saw quite a bit of them, because we were on the lower arm of the Rhine, and Arnhem is in the northern arm of the Rhine. Both were pretty damn big rivers. So on an assault basis, you could only go through floating bridges. And very often, I think we captured the bridge in Arnhem, fairly intact, a little damage. So it was used, but it was so damn exposed, and that it was pretty dangerous to go across, because it was under fire a good part of the time. And so we had a lot of other bridges crossed, and a lot of ferries. And then we actually didn't have too many bridges across, because we were actually going the other way. We were withdrawing back on our side. But there were a lot of ferries operating. Yes, dear.
I'll put that on.
Oh, he's a pretty good kid.
Alrighty, you were retreating from Arnhem? Or moving back from Arnhem, I should say.
No, we didn't move back from Arnhem. We never got anywhere near Arnhem. We got to Nijmegen, but we were supporting the people who were withdrawing from Arnhem and the Arnhem thing, because they had to all come back over our side of the.
This was after the operation failed.
That's right.
Now tell me, had you been given special orders? Like, the idea behind it was that the airborne troops would go in, and then the armor would push through and meet up with them and capture the bridges and whatnot. Had you been given special orders to follow up with the armor and the various other mobile units to go along with them and perhaps work on bridges?
No. We were not with our normal group when we were released from the Scheldt of South Beveland. We were then cantered right through to Nijmegen for a specific task, or for doing some specific tasks there. We were off in left field on the Walkland thing when all the others were going up the other way. And so we cantered through it and didn't do anything between the Scheldt activity and the back to Nijmegen.
Mm-hmm.
Went straight there for quite a lot of jobs. It was everything from general housekeeping of a heck of a lot of people who were quartered in at that stage. I think I built the biggest hot dog stand in Europe out of a Nissen hut, a huge thing.
This had to be for American troops.
No, it wasn't. It was for the Canadians.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there are no American troops there.
Yeah.
I think the morale wasn't too damn good, so they decided to make people as comfortable as possible. And of course, Christmas coming too.
Mm-hmm.
So
what's Christmas without hot dogs?
That's right.
It was a rather static period, though, wasn't it? I mean,
yes,
there wasn't
a
lot of movement.
It
and
was.
We were
pretty busy in the engineers. There were a lot of activity to do. For instance, at the same time as building this hot dog stand, which took a lot more effort and much more important than some of the other things,
mm-hmm.
we ran a regular ferry about 10 miles downstream, running back and forth for communication to the people who were, I think, the 101st U.S. Airborne and people in with that group.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran several special ferries to deliver heavy equipment over or back, I forgot which. We ran a special one time to lay a submarine cable on the darn thing. And all the signalers got medals, and poor corporal that ran the lane and did all the work didn't get any. Didn't even got to say thanks. It was just a normal day-to-day job for quite these concerns. Anyway, they were quite good. They were, by that time, getting very skilled with water floating equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't extremely good yet.
Well, how did the weather conditions affect? It was a rough winter, that winter of 44-45. From what I've heard, it was the worst they had in years. Did the rivers freeze up in places?
Yeah. Yes, it did. Not the big ones. The little ones did. Mm-hmm. They didn't freeze up enough that you could get across. There was a little worry about that, but there was almost all the little ponds and that sort of stuff were frozen. Mm-hmm. Didn't affect us very much. We had to go on doing the task. One task we had, again, not a very big one, but it was pretty important. Every day, four times a day, I'd go down and read a gauge to find out how much the water got up. Because the Germans blew a number of dikes and flooded quite a bit of land. Mm-hmm. And I remember going down this path one day. And, 2 days later, somebody got blown up on it, lost his legs on a Schumann. Same path we'd been on 50 times, I guess.
So you had been lucky and you'd missed it?
I wasn't on it very often. I did it one day. These things were tedious, I'd always do one of them to make sure, find out what the heck was being done, really. I didn't know there were any Schumanns around that area. Might not have gone if I had. But anyway, it just shows how you can get kind of careless. And you can't look everywhere. It's not until somebody gets blown up you realize there are some things going on.
Did you find that complacency was a problem with your unit? Or with any unit in
the field? Yes, in any unit it was. We had a little before then, I guess it was around South Devon, we lost a very good sergeant who was disarming a mine on part of mines. He didn't have to. It was just showing somebody how it's done. And it wasn't done that way. It went up, and so did three of them. Yes, they get slight complacency. Carelessness, I guess.
Yeah. Well, how was morale in general amongst the troops?
Very good. Very good.
I suppose if they kept busy, like you and your men were,
yeah.
You don't have time to think.
Yeah, we were really pretty happy. About that time, a little after that, when we got into the forest waiting for the salt crossing of the Rhine. Mm-hmm. I remember an instant where the British Naffy came up to see the pioneers and give them tea, a tea wagon. And did I tell you this story?
No. This strikes me funny. Naffy with tea in a row.